Welcome to Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. I'm your host, Elizabeth Moran, Editorial Director of Fixed Income News Australia. Join me as I talk about the latest news, views and education in fixed income investment. I'll be joined by industry experts from Australia and across the globe. Welcome. Today I have with me Richard Rausch, an investment director with Brandywine Global Investment Management, and we're going to be talking about investment cycles and the global fixed income market. Welcome, Richard.
Thanks, Liz. Good to be here.
So delighted to have you. So thinking about where we are in the investment cycle at the moment, and perhaps you can talk us through where you think we are, investors often think investment cycles are different this time. What's your take on what's happening in the market at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, we like to say that cycles are different, but they rhyme. And how they rhyme this time around, I think, might be a little bit different than previous cycles. So, you know, investment cycles are tied to economic cycles. That's why we, especially on the fixed income side or the macro side, we're obsessed with macroeconomic data and analysis. The two big ones being growth and inflation, right? But you know, just kind of stepping back in terms of how Brandywine Global's been looking at, you know, what's transpired pretty much since March of 2020, at the onset of the pandemic, is that this really has not been a normal cycle. If anything, this hasn't been a cycle at all. It was basically a natural disaster, meaning the, you know, the pandemic and then this crazy response, which in hindsight was, you know, probably too much at the time, probably warranted, which created all sorts of distortions, all sorts of economic distortions, all sorts of market distortions. And it's actually taken a long time for that to all play out, right? And I think, or we think, we're probably at the very tail end of those distortions and the normalization taking place. And now we can get back to our regularly scheduled programming of looking at the macro data, growth and inflation.
So it's different this time around because we've had a pandemic and it's been an extreme response. How do you think investors should go about positioning and think about positioning their portfolios? I mean, there's different data points out every day. US is going to hike, US is going to cut, it's hold for a lot longer. Perhaps if you could just talk us through that, that'd be great.
I think what's introduced some of this more recent market volatility is just ties into what I just said, which is that now everyone's hyper-focused on the macroeconomic data and the releases, whether it's domestically in Australia, what the RBA, you know, had to say yesterday, what Jay Powell in the US has to say, what, you know, other central bankers or officials around the world have to say. And there's just extra scrutiny on, you know, on every little release or in some case, big release, because that could kind of tip the hand as to where we're at. So how do you think about a portfolio, right? Well, I guess the good news from what's happened in the last 4 years, at least from a bond investor perspective, is that fixed income has income again, right? We've got yield. That's probably the biggest change that's taken place in the investment landscape in the past 4 years. And I think back a little bit, you know, I've been in fixed income markets for the majority of my career. You know, did predate the GFC. And, you know, when we got to about 2019, you know, hit the pandemic and then rates hit rock bottom again, you know, I was thinking to myself, you know, maybe I need a bit of a career change here. I'm not sure fixed income is going to do it. You know, I need to have a bit more longevity here. And, you know, when cash rates are at zero, bond yields are, you know, barely any better than that. And a lot of investors really discouraged by the asset class or looking elsewhere, whether it's private markets or property or whatever else. So like now, obviously things change pretty dramatically. We've had a big repricing of inflation expectations, a big repricing of rates. Cash rates obviously have moved higher. And so this is the big game changer from a portfolio perspective, right? You have yield. And you know, what do they say? Fear of missing out, FOMO or TINA, there is no alternative, whatever acronym you want to throw out there. I mean, there is an alternative now, right? You could buy cash, you know, park your money in term deposit, get I don't know, 4, 5, 6% in some cases, put your money in fixed income with a government rated AAA or AA for 10 years. You can get, you know, inflation linked bonds in the US, for example, for 10 years at a real yield of 2%, meaning that's inflation after inflation. You're pretty much guaranteed a 2% return after inflation over the next 10 years. That sounds pretty good to me, right? And so that's the big change that investors have to rethink. How much fixed income, how many defensive assets do I have in my portfolio? And do I really need to be taking all that risk in other parts of my portfolio?
Absolutely, absolutely. With where we are at the cycle now, do you think we're at the peak?
Yeah, that's, I mean, this is the question we wrestle with constantly. Look, I think the first thing I would say is it's a bit of a multi-speed world that's unfolding here. So not every country is in the same spot. And as we get, right, I think you're nodding along here.
I sure am. They're sure not.
And yeah, I not every country is in the same spot. There's been a lot of pain, you know, put on the consumer around the world, especially in the developed world, where we've seen, you know, the highest inflation in decades, right? And that's cumulative. I like to point out that, you know, when economists talk about inflation, they're obsessed with the rate of change. So inflation is a rate of change number. So when the RBA says, oh, you know, we want to get inflation back to, I don't know, 2-3%. That's 2-3% per annum going forward. Never mind the fact that prices are, I don't know, 20, 30, 40%, depending on your inflation basket, higher than they were, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. So there has been a lot of pain put on just your average person, on corporations, on global economies. And I like to point out the developed world in particular, who really haven't had to deal with this issue in decades. Are we at the top of this cycle? Well, there are a couple of things that are extending it, and probably the biggest one. So if I look around the world, and let's just quickly run around the world, and I think most people know what's going on in Australia, but I'll be brief about this. So Europe, I mean, for probably a decade plus, was kind of the sick man of the world. Growth is below trend. There are parts of Europe that are actually in recession. The UK obviously struggling with the after effects of Brexit, basically in recession, whether technical or not. I look at the other big economy around the world, the other two big economies being China and the US. So China growth relative to their at least recent history is pretty anemic. They're actually deflating. So we're getting a bit of deflation, a whiff of deflation out of China. They're really not supporting growth around the rest of the world. And that really leaves the U.S. as kind of the outlier. Now, this part of the world, we're really takers to what happens in those other big economies. If they're growing very strongly, we'll probably do well. If they're not, then we probably won't do great. So the U.S. has been the outlier. But I think I would argue that the reason they're an outlier is, you know, we'll see if it's sustainable. And probably the main difference between the U.S. and those other economies has been what's happening on the fiscal side, meaning government spending. It's just been off the charts for, you know, for an economy that's basically in full employment. Inflation's a little bit high. But these are all programs, again, after effects of these distortions from the pandemic. The U.S. government put in all these programs, and they've had a long tail, right? And there's been more spending. And it's very unusual to see this level of fiscal spending when you don't have a recession. And so this has really been propelling the U.S. And, you know, they give you a few truisms when you enter this business. One is, don't ever short JGBs, which is Japanese government bonds, which hurts people. Another one is never bet against the American consumer, right? Because the American consumer, you know, consumption is the biggest part of the U.S. economy. It's still by far the biggest economy in the world. It's been generating a lot of growth. So, and the consumer loves to spend, right? They have money, they spend money. And so these programs have really been propping up the consumer, been propping up corporates, has been generating a lot of positive growth. That was the big surprise last year. That's continued through so far this year. Very skeptical that's going to continue, with one notable exception. And I don't want to get over my skis here with politics, but you know, the election definitely is something you have to keep an eye on as an investor in the U.S. Because if we do have a split Congress in the U.S., then that fiscal spending almost certainly will come down. And I think that's actually a good thing. Now, it might not be so good for growth. So, you know, as this year unfolds, I think we're going to know how strong that fiscal impulse is and whether there's enough strength in the rest of the economy to keep it going. So I'd say we're towards the end. And look, I grew up in the U.S., so they use baseball metaphors, but I'll use a cricket one for the Australian audience, which is, you know, if we're in a, you know, a five-day tests, you know, we're probably in the last test at some point, and, you know, probably day three, right? We're towards the end of this, in my opinion.
Excellent. That's really good. Thank you so much. Moving on to Australia now and our small but growing fixed income market. As an investment director, does that make it necessary for investors to look globally in fixed income?
We think so, for various reasons. Now, I would say one thing up front, which is that Australia's bond market, by and large, and I say that it's not a homogenous thing, but the bond market, generally speaking, is highly correlated to other developed market bond markets, namely the U.S., right, being the biggest bond market in the world, but other kind of major developed bond markets. So they're going to move in similar directions. Yields will, you know, yields and prices obviously move in different directions. You know, they're going to track each other to a degree. Now, that might dislocate a little bit as the cycle evolves, but they're fairly correlated. And so where does that leave you in from an investor perspective in terms of, you know, the differences? Well, the two stats that I would look at, the two main ones when looking at either a portfolio or an index, would be, what's my yield? And there are various yield statistics. Yield to maturity is probably the best one. If you own a bond or a portfolio of bonds and you hold it to maturity, what is your annualized return going to be, assuming no defaults? And, you know, a 10-year bond in Australia right now, if you bought an Aussie government bond, is 4.3%. So that's your yield to maturity. You're going to get 4.3%, you know, on average between now and maturity. Now, that might come in a lumpy manner, depending what happens with rates in between. But yeah, the yield is probably the most important driver of what your total return is going to be outside of active management. We can get back to that in a minute. The other one would be, you know, the composition, the underlying composition of the market. And the big one would be your interest rate risk. So we call that duration, right? So how effectively how long or how sensitive your market is to moves in interest rates. And then the other variable would be your credit risk or your credit quality within a market. Now, Australia tends to be a bit shorter, so less interest rate risk sensitive, and a bit higher quality relative to global markets. Now, that might sound like a great thing, and yeah, it is. I mean, to a degree, we're victims of our own success here. The Aussie government's done a good job, by and large, relative to other you know, global governments in managing their affairs. So still has a high quality, haven't really extended issuance super far. But the issue is, you kind of, you know, there's no free lunch. So as a result, yields tend to be a bit lower, right? Depending on the market, but tend to be a little bit lower because it's a higher quality market and less risk. So it's basically a lower risk market. I guess the other thing about Australia that's somewhat unique is it is pretty concentrated, right? Same with our equity market. Very heavy on the banks, very heavy on certain industries like metals and mining, and being kind of levered to commodities. There are a few other corporate issuers that are global or would issue globally, but you know, much less diversification. And also within sectors, you don't. It's more concentrated, so it's predominantly an investment grade market. Whereas you go global, you not only do you open up pretty much every country around the world, both developed markets and emerging markets, but you open up other sectors, namely things like high yield, which I do joke. I do joke with people. This used to be called the junk bond market. Right. And this is the best rebranding exercise of all time. It's like, who wants to buy junk bonds? No one wants junk bonds, but high yield. Oh, yeah, these are really enticing. Right. And so now this is a high yield market. We really don't have a high yield market to speak of, mostly like lower quality corporates. They'll go through the banks directly. So maybe in the private markets you do, but not really in the public markets. And then things like securitized structured credit is bigger offshore. And then, of course, emerging markets, which, you know, I mentioned, I mean, there's tend to be governments, but they don't have to be. And you know, that's another kind of sub asset class, which is really interesting.
Fantastic. So a lot of reasons to think about going global with your portfolio. I know that there's often, you can often get better deals or better yields on foreign currency bonds issued by the same issuer compared to the domestic market. But can you give some examples perhaps of where the global market has performed better than the domestic market?
For people who don't know, if you're a big corporation, especially a global corporation, but it need not be, you want to borrow money to finance your business and operations, and you want the best possible deal on borrowing that money. And to do so, to have multiple diverse sources of funding, you want to ask everyone for money, right? That's the way I look at it. So if you're, I don't know, CBA, you're issuing debt in Aussie dollars, you're issuing different types of debt, hybrids and other things to fill in your capital structure. You're also potentially issuing in US dollars, you're issuing in euros, you're issuing, in some cases, you could issue in Japan, in Japanese yen. So same credit, right? Same company who's borrowing money, just, you know, catering to those other investor bases and in those different currencies. And, you know, they'll manage their currency risk and whatnot. So as a global investor, I guess you have the benefit of not just looking at those Aussie dollar denominated bonds. You could look at the US ones, you look at the Euro ones, look at the Japanese ones. You could just line them up and you say, okay, well, I'll take the one that's giving me the best deal. And there's very often dislocations here. Right. As you know, there's often dislocations here. So you pick the best one. And then, OK, you might say, well, wait a minute. I don't want U.S. dollars. I don't want, you know, this other risk. Well, that's where like the magic of, you know, things like derivatives and hedging come into play. So you can hedge that out. You could do certain things to offset those risks that are introduced. So I think that was sort of where you're going with the question. Yeah, I think that opens it up. Now, one other area that I think is interesting in terms of kind of cross-border is what happens in emerging markets. So in emerging markets, I don't know, let's look at Mexico. Mexico is probably a good one, even though increasingly developed looking. They can issue bonds, and you would know this, they can issue bonds either in their local currency. So, you know, just like a corporate, like a CBA would issue in Aussie dollars, Mexico, the government would issue in Mexican pesos, and there would be investors both domestically and offshore who would buy those. But they then could also issue in what we call hard currency. And what is hard currency? Well, typically US dollars or euros. And so now there are trade-offs to whether you invest as an investor in one or the other. It tends to have different investor bases, but much different return profile if you're buying a Mexican and bono, you know, bonds in Mexican pesos versus Mexican government bonds in US dollars. And so that's the kind of arbitrage you're looking for. You know, in a sense, it's the same credit, albeit they can print Mexican pesos. As far as I know, the Mexican government can't print US dollars or euros. So, you know, you have a little bit more runway there, but it's basically the same credit and you just play the cross-border arbitrage.
Excellent. I really like the way you're explaining things. And so thinking about some of the largest global issuers and you as an investment director, do you invest in like a CBA bond in multiple jurisdictions or you tend to just favor like the domestic one?
We do and we can. We tend to own multiple line items of if we decide to own a credit, you know, we tend to own multiple line items of that credit just for liquidity purposes. And from time to time, we'd own it in multiple currencies, right? Often they're issued in multiple currencies. So someone will come out with a big new issuance or a big deal and they'll do it in multiple maturities, multiple currencies. And, you know, we might just for diversification buy a few different ones. But look, I mean, we're a bit more of a high conviction manager, unconstrained, fairly high conviction. So you'll probably see a little bit more concentration in Brandywine's portfolios than maybe some others. And we tend to focus a little bit more on, depending on the product, a little bit more on sovereigns and government bonds and government-related bonds rather than, you know, individual corporate bonds. But we do a mix of both. So I guess the short answer is yes. And, you know, that's the beauty of being global, right? We can make that decision and the end investor doesn't have to worry about it.
That is the beauty of being global. Absolutely. If you invest in a fund, I think it's always good to really understand the benchmark. What are some of the common global benchmarks?
Let's take a second to, I won't completely throw benchmarks under the bus here in terms of, you know, their drawbacks, but let me just point out a couple before I dig into the actual indices that we look at. For bond investors in particular and bond indices in particular are particularly problematic. I think a lot of investors have problems with benchmarks and look, often we're forced to use them or there's regulatory reasons why we need them or peer reasons why we need them. But, you know, by and large, they are a representative of the market or a piece of the market. And so if you can't just beat the market and you can get that passively, then what are you doing, right? And so, you know, they do have their uses, but within fixed income, it's not a meritocracy at all. Is basically whoever is borrowing the most money gets the biggest weight in the index. You know, one example would be the Japanese government. They have basically the highest debt to GDP ratio in the world. And to finance that, they need to borrow money, right? They need to, and their ongoing kind of fiscal deficit, et cetera. So they need to continue to borrow money, continue to roll it over. And, you know, that means they have a big weight in the index. But there isn't necessarily a relationship between how much someone issues and the value of their bonds. And right now, I think we know that the Japanese are manipulating their bond market, keeping rates artificially very low, although like everyone else kind of has a bit of an inflation problem. And so, yeah, you could buy a 10-year government Japanese bond for less than 1%, or you could buy a, you know, Aussie government bond for 4%+. It's like, well, I know which one I'm taking, right? Even when you account for inflation. But the benchmark doesn't care. It just includes it as it is. Same goes with corporates. And corporates may be even more problematic, right? Just because of the credit risk involved with owning a corporate bond or the corporate bond market.
Yes, they can't print money like the Japanese can print the yen. So
exactly. And they don't always have like a captive investor base. Right. It's like, hey, if you give up on, GE, you know, then nobody's going to buy their debt anymore. And that goes down as a pretty quick downward spiral, as we see. So look, bond market indices are particularly problematic, even domestically. I mean, the government has been issuing way more debt than corporates on a relative basis. And therefore, the government weighting in the index has gone up tremendously. And so is that appropriate? Well, it just is what it is. That, you know, it just means you have a lot less corporate risk when you buy, I don't know, an index or an index fund or just the bond market in Australia than you used to. I don't think that's a great thing. It just is what it is. And so, look, it had been a one-way train for the last 20 years in terms of, you know, durations extending and certain trends going in one direction. And that has pulled back a little bit post-pandemic. But, you know, starting with more of a clean sheet of paper, where's the value? That's kind of how we think about it. And then going from there, and then you can kind of risk manage around there. So with that bit of a preamble, you know, equity markets are meritocracies. So whether you like it or not, you know, whether you like the fact that Microsoft is $3.5 trillion market cap or whatever it is, well, that's the value of the company. And so whatever that is, it is. And so, yeah, so on the bond market side, the big ones on the global front, indices are the global aggregate index. That is now run by Bloomberg. So I'm dating myself here a little bit. When I started out in my career, it was Lehman Brothers. And Lehman had the big bond, big bad bond business. And, you know, they were the best on indices. And so it's called the Lehman Ag or Lehman US Ag, Lehman Global Ag. And aggregate just means they're aggregating all investment grade bonds around the world. And, you know, there's certain liquidity parameters in there, what's allowed, what's not allowed. But by and large, it's pretty representative of the global bond market from an investment grade perspective. So the now it's then it went from Lehman to then Barclays, you know, basically bought Lehman, various Lehman businesses, including their index business. It was the Barclays Global Ag, now it's the Bloomberg Global Ag. So that would be like the ubiquitous main one that most global investors would use when you want all kind of sub-asset classes. If you want just corporate bonds, a lot of people look at the corporate subcomponent of the Global Ag. Now, if you want just government bonds, which is very common, a lot of our clients, institutions, and others, you know, they say, well, look, I want to separate my government bond exposure, my defensive assets from my growth assets, like credit would be in that bucket. So I'll index you or I'll put a benchmark of the WGBI, the World Government Bond Index, and that's now administered by FTSE. It used to be Citigroup, again, dating myself. And so that's really, it's very similar to the Global Ag. You just take out all the credit sectors. So just be pure government bonds.
Could you talk a little bit about, and we're sort of starting to wind up here, but could you talk a little bit about Brandywine's approach to fixed income investing and the funds you have available?
I do think Brandywine Global does have a fairly unique philosophy. And, you know, others have emulated it over the years. But, you know, going way back to, say, the early to mid 90s is really when we sort of pioneered this whole idea of unconstrained global bond investing. And you, if you think, I mean, our headquarters is in Philadelphia in the U.S., you know, back in the early 90s, I mean, we basically started as an equity shop. But we decided to move into fixed income. And back then it was like, especially in the US, people would just buy US fixed income. In Australia, they just buy Aussie fixed income or cash, right? And so it was a pretty big call to say, okay, forget about that. We're going to go global. And, you know, back then the WGBI, the World Government Bond Index, was the big one. And we said, okay, we have this index, but we're really not going to look at it. We're going to be totally unconstrained. We're going to look all around the world for the best, you know, risk-adjusted returns, and we're going to invest in those. And so this kind of ties into how the philosophy was built. So the philosophy, and then I'll get into how this ties into a couple of our products, is pretty simple. It's all about, it's all around, I guess, the whole concept of mean reversion. And so, you know, when we look around the world, interest rates, and this ties into what I said at the very beginning, with the macro side, interest rates, currencies, and credit spreads, they're basically the ultimate regulators of economic activity. And they tend to, you know, they ebb and flow every day, you know, currency markets change every day. And they tend to every once in a while over or undershoot in a pretty material way. So you have a really big dislocation, and that starts to impact behavior. It impacts an economy, it impacts policy. I'll give you a local example. You know, if the Aussie dollar, I mean, we have the opposite problem now, maybe, but say 10 years ago, the Aussie dollar was going higher and higher and higher. That actually becomes very difficult on the economy, on certain parts of the economy, right? So exporters are much less, attractive, their products in Aussie dollars. People don't want to come here and visit. I don't know about you, but it's going to be, now that the Aussie dollar is relatively weak, it's going to be quite the expensive holiday going to America, right?
Oh, no, I'm not going there.
and I suspect, I know where you'd like to go, which is probably Japan, because their currency is at like a 40-year low. But in any case, this starts to impact behavior. It'll impact policy. So maybe the central bank is going to intervene. Maybe they're going to cut rates to kind of make sure capital doesn't keep flowing in here. Maybe the government steps in and does something. The point is, like, there's this chain reaction because of all the impacts that the, rates, currencies, and credit have on the economy that cause these things to normalize, right? Go the other direction. And at some point, the Aussie dollar started to fall, right? And for various reasons, it had an impact on slowing the economy. There were probably interventions, other things going on. And this happens time and time again in every country, basically around the world. And the point around our philosophy is you want to look at those, you know, where there's a true anomaly. And that's where you want to focus your efforts. You then combine that with value. You know, so if a bond market or a currency market based on various valuation metrics looks particularly attractive, and there's some sort of catalyst for that mean reversion to happen, well, that's where you put on kind of big, meaningful, active positions. And it's as simple as that. And so, you know, you do see with a value orientation, we tend to be contrarian, which people have relatively short investment timeframes, although they might think they have long time horizons. Clients are definitely ringing me sometimes on short-term performance. And look, we look at it every day. But when we actually invest the portfolios, it's for a medium to long-term time horizon. And so, you know, over time, it does work and it plays out. And when you've got a 30-plus year kind of track record, I think you can point to that. And even when things are uncomfortable, that's probably the best investment opportunity. So that's kind of the philosophy, how that applies to our products. We have two main products in market in Australia. I mean, we have others or other flavors, and we have, a very large institutional business, both locally in Australia with some of the biggest institutions and super funds and globally offshore. But our two main products, which tie into kind of two of our flagship approaches, are the Brandywine Global Opportunistic Fixed Income Fund and the Brandywine Global Income Optimizer Fund. So, they do do rhyme in terms of how we position portfolios, but the levers that we pull within those funds are quite different. And it really depends on how the client is using it, whether they pick one or the other. So very quickly on the Global Opportunistic Fixed Income Fund, we call it GOFI. For short, we have acronyms for everything. But so the GOFI fund, this is predominantly a macro interest rates and currency product where, look, over a long period of time, it will look like a bond fund. It will quack like a bond fund. But on a day-to-day basis, it'll look probably nothing like an index. To my comments earlier, we think that's a feature, not a bug. Like, that's a good thing. But this is, this is taking substantial active positions on, you know, positive real yielding bond markets around the world, both in developed and emerging markets. And also taking views on currencies. I said that currencies are these big regulators of activity. Well, if we think that from a philosophical perspective, you know, and you think Mexico is going to appreciate, well, it's probably their bond market's going to do well and their currency is going to do well. So you get kind of get both, right? That's the beauty about being global and having those levers. We do credit in these portfolios, but much more opportunistically. Right now, we're really not involved in credit because of where credit spreads are trading. Now, that doesn't mean credit is unattractive. It just means there's no dislocation in credit. So think COVID, think GFC, think some of these big moments where there's a big dislocation. That's when we'll get heavily involved in this opportunistic portfolio, hence the name. So that would be kind of our longest standing global product. Then Global Income Optimizer was set up to really solve a few different problems. But by and large, this is downweighting a lot of what we do on the currency front and adding credit, right? And so as a result, it could be a little bit more like a little bit more stable, a little bit more through the cycle. Instead of having a fixed income index, we have a cash-based index, bank bills. Which means, look, it doesn't mean every day, every week, every month we're going to beat cash, right? It's still a bond fund. But over the long run, you know, it's going to look for the best risk-adjusted returns and, you know, isn't forced really to have that longer duration profile or credit profile that a lot of bond funds have. Look, and there is this yield kind of objective. Meaning that we're going to own things and it tends to be a higher yielding portfolio than you'll see in the GOFI portfolio. So look, I think they're nice complements to each other. And, you know, I think either do well when paired with a domestic Aussie manager and both do well with like a global passive manager. It's kind of like the core satellite approach. And we tend to fill the role as the satellite in many portfolios.
Richard, I just want to thank you on behalf of all our listeners. Your explanations were fantastic and easy to understand, and you're a true educator at heart. I think you might have a second career there somewhere, but thank you very much for joining us today at Fixed Income News Australia, and we hope sometime you might come back.
No, Liz, my pleasure. I enjoyed that. And yeah, thanks for having me. Looking forward to the next time.
Thank you for joining us this week on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast. Still hungry for more fixed income news, views and education? Then visit fixedincomenews.com.au and don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter to have the latest news delivered right to your inbox. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Elizabeth Moran and we'll see you next episode on Fixated, the Fixed Income Podcast.